lives there and graduated from BYU with a degree in political science. He completed 2 years of graduate studies at the University of Utah and earned an MA and PhD at the University of Southern California in international relations. He taught at BYU from 1975 to 1983 before moving to the Washington, D.C. area to work on Middle East policy and Arab-American civil rights issues. He's been a private consultant to corporate and government clients, conducting management training seminars and providing services to international businesses. He currently owns a government contracting firm which specializes in training and international technical assistance. And I first heard of Omar 10 years ago when I was an intern on the Ted Wilson Senate campaign, and he was famous because he was the Democrat in Utah County, and they needed to win his support. J. Michael Allen will respond to his paper, and Michael describes himself as a half-Californian and half-Utahan, spending his early years in California and his more recent years in Utah. He has a BA from BYU and a master's degree in history from Berkeley and is just a few months away from receiving his PhD from the University of Washington. He has been a full-time faculty member at Brigham Young for the last 2 years, and before coming to BYU, he taught at the University of Victoria. Omar?
Thank you. I'm glad to be here today. I hadn't intended to come to Sunstone in Salt Lake. I've never come before, but this year I made a special trip because I found that so many people were encouraged not to come, and so I felt like I had to come. I hope the church doesn't encourage members not to come next year because I don't want to come. A couple of years ago, I was at a conference in Washington, D.C. on freedom of speech and democracy in the Arab world. And there was a panel going on about how deplorable conditions were in the Arab and Muslim world concerning freedom, freedom of the press, freedom of assembly, academic freedom for university professors. And as the talks went on, one fellow specifically talked about the brutal regime of Saddam Hussein and went on in some detail about the brutality of the regime and who was suffering at their hands, and how the secret police were really working over Iraqis. And after he finished, I was sitting near the front row, and a fellow jumped up next to me, and he said, "I'm from the Iraqi embassy, and we have ways of dealing with people like you." Well, everybody erupted in roarious laughter because the guy had forgotten the title of the panel, which was Free Speech and Democracy in the Arab World. And he turned around in bewilderment. And it occurred to me at that moment that he didn't understand the whole concept of free speech. He didn't understand democracy. He didn't understand free press. He just didn't understand anything to do with letting people think freely and then allow it to go in whatever direction within certain confines. I find that academic freedom and the freedoms we enjoy in this country are misunderstood worldwide. And for too long, we have assumed that we don't understand the world. And I don't think the world understands America. And sometimes we don't understand ourselves. And sometimes we fear our own product. And I think that the freedoms that the American Constitution, the freedoms that American custom has evolved by 1992 are abstract principles that need far more attention. We can't just assume them. We can't assume that children entering kindergarten will emerge in a 12th grade or as college graduates understanding what the First Amendment or the First Ten Amendments are about. And so these dialogues that we go through here at Sunstone and elsewhere are manifestations, I think, of the misunderstanding of our own system. I want to take you through a paper that I've written that's too long, and Michael Allen has been gracious enough to go through 49 pages of single space that I haven't made available because it's in too rough a form, but I'm going to go through and summarize a good part of what I want to talk about today, and let me just give you my summary first, then come back around. This paper, it's not possible, is my thesis, for a university in the classical sense to be run by a church because of the impinging influence on academic freedom. It is not possible to be a university in the classical sense without being impinged on by a church in academic freedom. BYU has a conflicting mission. It calls for a church mission, and it calls for a mission of an institution committed to a classical liberal education. But it is not possible to be a respected university when faith is elevated as superior into a superior position over reason. The two are independent issues and should be a part of any good university education and an equal part of any good university education. The church must give up control of BYU and avoid the negative attention it will continue to draw by curtailing academic freedom in the name of doctrinal purity. In giving up the university, the church could maintain a separate religion faculty at BYU and offer students classes as is done at other universities through institute programs, or it could just take a religion, philosophy, ethics college and separate it and take complete control of those colleges and let the rest of it go by itself. This paper is delivered in the spirit of an active member who does not assume to know the minds of church leaders or BYU officials. I'm responding to publicly printed material which point in an unhealthy direction. It's my view that many in the church and at BYU do not fully appreciate the full stature and academic reputation of BYU as it has been established over the years. The current debate erodes those gains that BYU has made to gain a position of respectability in the United States. And those gains are being eroded by this debate and can only lead to a diminished university and negative publicity to the church at every effort that is aimed at curtailing academic freedom. Now, there are a lot of reasons that I speak out, a lot of reasons that I come from Washington to Utah, especially to address this issue. I feel like oftentimes that I skirt up against the accusations of being an Uncle Tom in my own Arab American community by walking a straight and narrow line, by remaining silent. And one of the reasons I came today is not because I want to challenge the church. I'm a perfectly happy, active member. Not because I want to challenge BYU. But I felt like my whole life has been one where I'm the luckiest person in the world to be born in this country, having immigrant parents. And to sit back and watch what I consider to be not religious influences, but extreme right-wing bigoted influences move the direction of discourse in this country in an unhealthy direction. And every time you curtail freedom, we have to speak out. And I'm thinking more about some of the things that Bonner Ritchie said last night about the individual dignity and fighting against organizations that abuse individuals. And I feel like we all have an obligation to do that. So I take this paper for a call to those of us who sit back quietly and either are afraid or don't want to be bothered to action, and ask you all to join me in not speaking out of courage, but speak out of decency. All too often, we have turned decency into courage because of fear. And I'd like to end that. And I'd like to speak as an American here, not as just as a member of the church. But can you imagine discussing freedom in America today when we're exporting it abroad? Let's think about it in terms of what we're entitled to talk about. My first question, is it possible for BYU to manage the tension of being a church-sponsored university and meet the conflicting demands of its sponsor and its faculty? Is the trend towards becoming a secular university reversible? Is it possible for any church to sponsor a university without facing charges of insensitivity towards academic freedom? Now, let me just give you a quick personal background as a kind of a disclaimer to say I have standing to address this issue. I'm a native of Provo, born and raised a Muslim in Provo. My parents immigrated from Arab Palestine before World War I, and I was reared as one of eight members in a strict Muslim household. Both parents made their pilgrimage to Mecca from Provo and back. I have a special relationship with BYU, having grown up in the community. I attended the university both as a non-Mormon and after I joined the church, taught there. I attended public schools in Provo, graduated from BYU with a degree in international relations and political science. I completed 2 years of graduate study in Arabic at the University of Utah, where I studied Islamic society and Islamic literature. I completed my MA and PhD in the University of Southern Cal in international relations. And then I came back to teach at BYU. And it was a wonderful experience and amazing from my youthful non-Mormon background as I went back to BYU to become a part of an institution that I had only looked at from the outside. I taught the senior MBA program, the course on ethics with Bonner Ritchie, the famous course where Bonner Ritchie started out the semester by telling them they are all SOBs and they had to prove otherwise. Bonner could say things like that because his ancestors pulled a handcart across the plains. that any sense that he used camels. I taught political science for the whole 8 years and was assistant to the dean of the College of Social Sciences as my official title. I'm currently in private business, own my own contracting firm. When I completed my studies at BYU in 71 and went off to the University of Utah and pursued a graduate degree, I had no intention of returning to BYU. I was lucky. I was fortunate. I considered it a great opportunity, and I still do, and I'm grateful for that opportunity. As a convert to the church, I have never discussed issues of faith publicly, nor do I engage in debate over church policy or doctrine. Mine is a deep and simple faith that's not subject to debate or rational analysis. I practice a very private belief and consider myself a vigorous proponent of the church, BYU, and the state of Utah, especially in my work abroad. I never miss an opportunity to introduce the church to strangers or Utah or Mormons. During the last 5 years, I have invited and brought to Utah over 10 ambassadors from Arab countries. I take them to the University of Utah, to BYU, and I always take them to meet the First Presidency. The impression is always extremely favorable. In the case of Jordan, it was so favorable that we developed a relationship with the church that remains close to this day, and we have opened offices in Jordan and continue sending fellowshipping couples. That was the original intent, and I'm very pleased to play a part in that, and I will continue to do that. While at BYU, I experienced the benefit of mentors, protectors, nurturers who sustained me through a period of orientation into an academic world of a unique university. While enjoying an umbrella of supporters, there existed a significant number of detractors whose motivations varied from smug arrogance to racism towards anyone who did not fit the idealized stereotype of a BYU professor. There were people who whispered and murmured their ugly little secrets, who suggested even being that I was possibly even a communist because I was a Democrat. I was even accused of being a Palestinian at one time. I also benefited from having sat on a high council with Bonner Ritchie and a few others, which was my introduction into church governance, which was turned out to be a very positive experience and eventually led to my becoming a bishop. And that was a wonderful experience that I don't regret at all, and have fond memories of the experience that I was allowed to have in that calling. The most difficult times at BYU were those spent negotiating with people who acted as though they knew the minds of general authorities and therefore offered the wisest counsel. When questioned about their sources of wisdom and told that I would not mind discussing any problems with general authorities personally, I was always, always able to take people who thought they represented general authorities and reduce them to nothing by just suggesting, would you mind giving me the number of the fellow you talk to? Because they never do talk to general authorities. They just think they do. And some have umbilical cords 1,000 miles long that think that because they're related, they have great ideas. One fellow at BYU had the bad habit of regularly challenging my right to be a visible Democrat and work at BYU. His threats were easily turned away by merely challenging my right to free speech and asking him to produce the university handbook. One reason I suppose I was so regularly challenged had to do with those weak individuals who needed a whipping boy and considered my ethnicity or activity in the Democratic Party to be a vulnerability. I considered my activity in the Utah Democratic Party an asset to the church and BYU, and I still do. When I was called to be a bishop on campus, Ward, there were a number of the religious faculty that did oppose me, and publicly, and talked to students about me. I was counseled to keep quiet long enough for it to be handled. And one was released as a state president for, among other problems, his constant rumor-mongering. I have always treated my employment like I do any other employment, with respect to the unique culture, rules, and customs that dominate your work environment. I believe that I knew what I was getting into when I made the decision to go to BYU and teach, and when I left 8 years later, it was a wonderful experience that I cherish to this day. I had no reservations about going to BYU. I knew what it required. I knew the university climate was a safe place for free thinking and research. I also knew that BYU had unique requirements concerning the church, but in my field of international relations, there were no hazards for me. I experienced 8 very stimulating years of teaching, some of the brightest students in America. BYU is a great place to send our sons and daughters for academic training. It has all the necessary ingredients to become one of the great universities of this country. When I left BYU in 83, it was my view that the climate was improving in every field. I was at BYU during the 70s when the 60s climate still caused a good deal of tension. Why then in the 90s are we different? What's happened since the 1970s? Is there a worse climate? Is there a serious problem regarding BYU's relationship with the church? Should we be alarmed at church spokesmen are instructing members on issues involving free speech and academic freedom regarding attendance at symposia? Can the issues be resolved without drawing negative public attention that harms BYU or the church? Those are the questions that I address. Now I want to go through and just talk for a bit about what a real university is and compare it to BYU's mission, and there isn't a difference. It's how we practice it. Let me quote from out of a book by Derek Bok, the past president of Harvard, on what a student ought to have as part of their education. To cite the most common aims, undergraduates should acquire an ample store of knowledge, both in depth by concentrating in a particular field and in breadth by devoting attention to several different disciplines. They should gain an ability to communicate with precision and style, a basic competence in quantitative skills and qualitative skills, a familiarity with at least one foreign language, and a capacity to think clearly and critically. Students should also become acquainted with the important methods of inquiry and thought by which we acquire knowledge and understanding of nature, society, and ourselves. They should develop an awareness of other cultures with their differing values, traditions, and institutions. By having the chance to explore many opportunities, they should acquire lasting intellectual and cultural interest, gain a self-knowledge, and ultimately be able to make sound choices about their future lives and careers. Through working and living with a wide variety of fellow students, they should achieve greater social maturity and acquire a tolerance of human diversity. Last but not least, they should enjoy their college years, or at least look back on them later as a time when their interests and enthusiasms were engaged in a particularly memorable way. There's a new book issued this year, and as you read that statement, I'm not convinced that BYU students have it much differently if they want it. I'm not sure that it's always available because of their own motivations, but I think that definition of what a student should get in an undergraduate education is available at BYU. There's a new book out this year issued by Yaroslav Pelikan called The Idea of the University, and it's a reexamination of John Henry Cardinal Newman's book, The Idea of a University, published in 1852. And Newman simply states that the ideal university should be a place of teaching universal knowledge. And that universal knowledge comes from faith and reason. There is no competition between the two. You just put them on the same plane and let them function. And they do four things. They advance knowledge through research at the university, the transmission of knowledge through teaching, the preservation of knowledge through scholarly collections in libraries, and fourth, the diffusion of knowledge through publishing. And to be an ideal university, you have to do research, teaching, have a library, and publish. And a well-rounded university has all of those. But individuals may not have all four of those capabilities. Not everybody collects a library, so you have a central library. Not everybody does good research, and not everybody is a good teacher. And so sometimes you divide it. Some work solely on research, and some become excellent teachers. But you can't be an excellent teacher without doing research, according to Pelikan. Here's Pelikan quoting Newman. When Newman entitled the ninth and last of his discourses, Duties of the Church Towards Knowledge, he was acknowledging also, on the basis of his own often bitter experience as a man with a foot in each camp, talking about the competition between faith and reason, the long record of hostility and natural recrimination between church and university. It is a record of hostility to which, during the century or so since Newman, extremists in both institutions have somehow managed to go on making ever new contributions. But in one respect at least, the two institutions have much in common. Despite dismissals of the hysterical hyperbole of crisis, both are caught today in the throes of a situation that it is difficult to describe as anything less than a crisis. A crisis of confidence. That is, at the same time, a crisis of self-confidence. He calls for an acknowledgement that there is a crisis in the university and a crisis in the church in America today. When I mean the church, I mean churches in America today. Each in its own way, both the university and the church, though the latter even more than the former, are often dismissed by those who claim to speak on behalf of the real world as museum pieces from another. simpler era. Still good places, perhaps, for the young to learn something about the past, but definitely not the place to look for guidance about the real world and its future. So we have those who advocate the divorce from faith and go purely secular, advocate reason, and those who promote purely faith and knowledge through revelation, attacking reason, on separate camps when I don't think that they need to be separated, and I don't think BYU or any other university has to separate faith from reason. You can have both. The difference at BYU, in my impression, is that those who advocate faith through revelation are not advocating a theology. They're advocating anti-intellectualism. They're not just renouncing reason. They're renouncing intellectuals. They're renouncing research. They're renouncing the classical university, as I think it's described over the ages. The university, according to Newman, is a place where professors must be left to pursue their studies in an idyllic setting, free from the encumbering distractions of everyday life and confusion over the mission and meaning of the university. Quote, he made it clear that scholars should be permitted to proceed freely in their speculations, research, or conclusions in their particular science. And he called upon religious writers, jurists, economists, physiologists, chemists, geologists, and historians to go on quietly and in a neighborly way in their own respective lines of speculation, research, and experiment, and to be left alone from the hindrances of the outside. I think that's what a real university is about, is that freedom to pursue your own interests. Now let's talk about church-sponsored education just for a moment. There is the debate between the primary mission that is religious versus the one that allows the university to follow its natural evolution into a secular institution. That's central at BYU today, I think, and the future will have to resolve how religion will play a role in the role of the university. Religion will always be a central focus at BYU as long as the Mormon Church is a sponsor. I think the Mormon Church has a right to dictate and control BYU. I think BYU has a right to tell its professors what to do. I think BYU has a right to fire professors. I think the church has a right to tell BYU administrators to fire professors. And I think BYU professors have no right to claim that they don't have a right to be fired, because it is a church-controlled university, and I respect that right. But neither the church nor BYU has a right to call it a university. They can call it a seminary, they can call it anything else they want, but that right... But I think we have to respect that right. My question is, if the church has a right to fire those people, and BYU has a right to fire them, and I respect that right, academics who stay must sign on and accept it and not complain. And if you can't accept it, you have to leave. Or there's a last difficult one. That is, if you really are truly committed to academic freedom, you have to stay and fight and pay the consequences. And the consequences may be isolation, to be alone, to be targeted of investigation, and all other kinds of activities. If you want to change the climate at BYU, there is a price to pay. But BYU cannot be fully accredited as a university and fire its professors for academic deviance. Now, that's the battle. I think BYU is a university. And until they fire somebody for academic deviance, then we will have to urge that they change their name to Brigham Young Academy or Brigham Young Seminary or something else. But until that happens, we have to challenge. When the distinction, let me quote here from Pelican again out of Newman. When the distinction between knowledge and faith, or for that matter, the separation between church and state, is interpreted as a justification for the professed knowledge about human life and society, about human history and culture, that is as ignorant about faith dimension as much the current scholarship of humanists and social scientists in many universities, especially in the Soviet Union and Western Europe, and in the United States, such knowledge is fundamentally deficient. Knowledge without faith is fundamentally deficient. Deficient as knowledge and as scholarship, completely apart from what it may or may not mean for the life of faith. This may put professors of English into the enviable position, pedagogically, of being able to teach Milton's Paradise Lost to students who do not know how the story comes out, and therefore wait in suspense to see whether Adam and Eve eat the apple. But such reductionism can easily distort the person's societies and texts with which it deals by requiring them to conform to its own inability to imagine that anyone could ever have really believed any of this, and therefore to its assumptions that there must be some other explanation. By its very nature, the course, the knowledge, and scholarly study of faith can be not only controversial but contagious. It can lead to lifelong believers to surrender cherished tenets of faith, or it can engage students existentially in such a way that, having come to observe and criticize, they remain to pray. The university must not pretend that either of these outcomes cannot happen within its walls, nor should it. In its care for its members as human beings, dismiss such concerns as trivial. But for the pursuit of knowledge as an end in itself, the university is at the very least obliged to pay attention also to the knowledge of this dimension in its subject matter. I think a case can be made in BYU's academic freedom statement for including religious education as part of a scholarly pursuit. Now, deal with this academic freedom statement in a minute. I consider it weak, lame, and cynical. And I want not to be mistaken about that, because I think that there were intelligent people who were playing with their own training in writing that statement. I'm embarrassed for them. The church will eventually have to make a tough choice, and it will have to make one of three: maintain BYU as a church-sponsored university and continue the stresses and strains that go with governing an academic institution. And that route allows the church to ensure that the university does not stray from its mission as defined by the church. That would involve a constant battle surrounding academic freedom if they maintain control, and I think it would harm the church and BYU. The second is that the church could maintain a close relationship but allow the university to pursue its academic mission, and that would cause continuous embarrassment for the church because they would consider what goes on at BYU a reflection on the church. And the third is what I advocate: the church should divest itself of interest in BYU like it did the hospitals, and let the university seek its own natural role in a world of academic institution. The option of divesting control and financial sponsorship of BYU allows the church latitude. The religion faculty could be kept as a church-sponsored college or seminary, while maintaining a close and cooperative relationship with the university as a whole. A board could be made up of loyal members of the church who govern the university in a way that wouldn't harm the church now or in the future. A faculty with more latitude would have less worry about church control and more concern about fundraising. Members who want their children to attend church-sponsored schools but find admission at BYU more difficult would be free to go elsewhere because it'd be more seminaries and institutes at other institutions. It would also let BYU administrators off the hook in a time of increasing demands for enrollment and decreasing space for that demand. Additionally, if the church divests itself of interest in BYU, it would allow the university to enter the competition for more federal funds, and BYU could continue its progress towards a national academic respectability by having more freedom. There would be less embarrassment and confrontations with the church all the way around. To continue close relationship and control of BYU, I think the church will be continually criticized by outside institutions such as accreditation. It will be accused of insensitivity towards academic freedom. But the basic issue is simple. It is not possible for a church, any church, to maintain control of a university and not interfere on a regular basis with academic freedom of its faculty. Free inquiry runs contrary to dogmas of churches. The experience of the Catholics in this country is ample evidence that the control of the university life is not compatible with the free spirit of academic inquiry. The limitations placed on churches regarding control of universities they sponsor and issues of academic freedom are understood and accepted by people who work there. However, the cost of such control will always be a central issue in characterizing the contention and conflict. Ultimately, both the university and the church suffer from such conflicts, and neither get what they want. Let me just summarize very quickly what I consider to be the constituents at BYU, those people who care about it, and the goals or the objects of BYU. BYU's constituents are nine. There are the students, the parents, the alumni, the general authorities, church membership generally, the academic community, the public, the faculty, and the local community and around a university. And they all compete for attention at the university. The objects of the university, especially BYU, is to educate their students, provide cultural and church education, missionary symbol and resources, church leadership training, research for the church and academic research, church support system, resources for special projects, indoctrination of members, and provide an environment for Mormon youth to meet and marry. Now, the church is locked in an untenable position at BYU, and I think it's a dead end. I think that they will always continue to run up against very intelligent and gutsy faculty, faculty who aren't afraid. And those faculty who aren't afraid will always be the subject of abuse. And the rest of us sit back. We either join in defending that faculty or play like, and I mean play like in the childish sense, of being good active members while brothers and sisters are abused. Now I want to talk about the church in BYU has itself in as a structural bind. The Mormon Church established BYU for the purpose of providing, quote, an environment enlightened by living prophets and sustained by those moral virtues which characterize the life and teachings of the Son of Man. Additionally, it states, this is in the mission statement, any education is inadequate which does not emphasize that His is the only name given under heaven whereby mankind can be saved. These statements are important to the foundation of the church and its teachings. No one can argue with these beliefs as they are sacred and cherished doctrines of the Mormon Church. The BYU mission statement also states that, quote, scholarly research and creative endeavor among both faculty and students, including those in selected graduate programs of real consequence, are essential and are encouraged. It also calls for a broad university education. I think that's the clash. How do you take a bright and capable student body among the best faculty in the world, trained faculty in the world, and put them in the same body and ask them to produce a fine university under church control? I think it's incompatible and difficult. I'm just not convinced it's possible without a lot of stress and strain, and I'll explain why. And then in the end, I'll give you four cases of what the church ought to do to if it wants to maintain control. Among them is to get a rack and put people on the rack and crank them up. And I'll explain how to do that in a minute. I'm not going to just come and pontificate. I've got solutions here. An example of that outside interference is the latest statement on academic control. I'm talking about the church controlling academic freedom. It says, we believe the subject of academic freedom, perhaps above all, this is BYU's academic freedom statement, above all others, should be governed by the maximum possible extent by the faculty itself. Thus, the process we are following here seeks to create a jointly developed policy in which our entire academic community has some ownership, reflecting interaction among the faculty, the administration, and the governing board. The leadership role of the original committee and an open period of discussion among the faculty should allow us to establish, insofar as consensus is possible within a large and diverse community, a truly collective view about the nature of the university and its spiritual and intellectual commitment. This is the draft statement. Academic freedom is not anarchy, it's not abuse, and it's not disrespect. Every university has its uniqueness, as shall be shown below in Father Curran's case at Catholic University. Pursuing the goals of a university at the same time maintaining a good standing with the board is a problem that every university in America has, not just Brigham Young. I will skip over a lot of the details. Excuse me, the details of the academic freedom agenda, but let me just quote you the summary. Paragraph 5. Hence, at BYU, individual academic freedom means more than it does at secular universities. It is based not only on the belief shared by all universities in the value of free inquiry, but also on the gospel principle that humans are free agents who should seek knowledge in the sacred as well as the secular, by the heart and the spirit as well as by the mind, and in continuing revelation as well as in the written word of God. BYU students and their parents are entitled to expect a university or an educational experience that reflects this aspiration. I found that fascinating, that their way of expanding academic freedom was to include religion. They didn't do their homework. This is not the work of academics. This is the work of a professional, a technical writer. This is not someone who has read the works of the what I would consider a Renaissance scholar of the meaning of the university over the years. This is a lawyer's document. This is a brief, and it's weak. I think you could select a group of sophomores from BYU or any university in the country and come up with a more respected academic freedom document in 10 days than it took to do this. This is embarrassing. The inclusion of religion as a basis for expanding a university's legitimacy as an institution which promotes pluralism as academic freedom is a precarious notion. I'm reading my own material here. Carried to its logical extension, every medical school in the country would do well to include chiropractics, osteopathics, hypnosis, and faith healing in a medical education in order to be a more broadly based medical training. The inclusion of religion as part of university education is as legitimate as the inclusion of chemistry or physics. The problem arises when religion is elevated to a position of dominance and control over departments in the university. The university must resist undue influence or control by any approach to the pursuit of knowledge, including the scientific method. The issue, again, is freedom. The one area which is restricted is reasonable. I wouldn't defend the right to criticize church officials, oppose church doctrine, or violate the honor code, as well as within the limits of any other prohibition. The one, in fact, that you might expect from every church university is honorable and decent lifestyle. And I would expect that the church to be able to do that. However, there is no need to justify the inclusion of religious education in the mission of the university when based on a legitimate and logical extension of an institution's mission and purpose, as is the case with BYU and the church. The university's effort to justify its pursuit of religious education by stating that the inclusion of such an education expands the definition of academic freedom is cynical. There is a rich justification for including religion in and its place in the human experience in the education of students without using the disingenuous misapplication of free speech and academic freedom in this debate. These are important and fundamental principles of democracy. Their use in this context raises more controversial issues rather than settles them. Now I want to go on and talk about free speech for a minute. I see two fundamental reasons for free speech. One is to keep people in power honest, and the other is to protect minority views. The search for truth is maintaining the honesty of officials who have a monopoly on power and therefore control over the means of enforcement and to the protection of minority views. The protection of unpopular ideas is the one area that suffers most at BYU. This is not so much that the university lacks sensitivity or that there is a lack of diversity. In fact, there are many voices heard at BYU that are out of the mainstream in the United States. Many extremist right-wing views at BYU get an open hearing. Giving an open hearing to the views of right-wingers and those who are intolerant and bigoted and racist is indeed a form of free speech, and BYU must be recognized as a place that is liberal in accepting those extremists. BYU is to be commended for tolerating the unpopular views of the right wing. For the last 35 years, the university has ignored many trends that swept up other campuses, such as the civil rights and anti-war movement, instead taking the path that the national right wing took. However, there are some troubling issues that emerge from a lack of public discourse involving political preference. There is an unhealthy cultural attribute that disdains free speech and values silence, masking as prudence, as though there is a consensus on important and controversial issues that shape the intellectual climate at BYU. At BYU, fear to speak out on issues that are thought to go against prevailing notions has created a lackey mentality among some students and faculty. Far too many fear to speak out, fear to speak their minds publicly, but express their views secretly to friendly authorities who tolerate subterranean vicious character assassination. The disturbing fact is that BYU and the church have nurtured a culture of informers. They have tolerated and even rewarded quislings without regard to one's right to free speech or the right to face accusers. Quislings has become an adjective described after a fellow in 1945 when the Nazis took over Norway, and he cooperated with the Nazis as a Norwegian. He was an informer on the inside, and they've used his name, Quisling, to describe insiders who report to outsiders. It is distressing to see the practice of ratting honored. I searched my thesaurus, and I can find nothing more honorable than these words that I've found. It is distressing to see the practice of ratting honored. When a general authority or BYU university official secretly accepts criticism of a brother or sister in the church without assisting the informer by teaching them how to openly confront disturbing issues through the democratic principle of free speech, they give credibility and respect to the despicable practice of ratting. The lack of free speech creates secrecy and murmuring and gossip. It should be repudiated as a tool of repressive societies more common under dictatorships than American churches. There is no honor in being a stool pigeon. Far too many students and an embarrassingly significant number of BYU faculty who lack courage engage in this evil practice of turning in their brothers and sisters at the university, assuming they are defending the faith or serving a higher purpose. They do the church, the university, and people they report great harm. It is an unworthy example for young students to have their minds twisted by encouraging them to practice passing on secret information instead of learning how to participate in an open and free society dedicated to free speech with impunity. It makes for inferior citizens and diminishes our great country to resort to authority instead of practicing free speech. Those who lack the mettle to practice that right of free speech, instead resorting to the devious methods of secretly ratting, should stop their shameful practice. The church and the university should do everything within their powers to change this awful and disgraceful habit because it makes for a society of weak characters. Students who lack maturity or good judgment regarding the fundamental constitutional right of free speech are denied an opportunity to learn how to become good Christians, informed ethical citizens, when they are exposed to a culture that turns a blind eye to shabby, sinister, and corrupt practice of duplicity, deception regarding informing on their fellow students and professors. There is a cultural trait at BYU that encourages students who hear new ideas from their professors or fellow students to run and rat. I'm going to end that part and talk about what we can do, because we've run out of time and I've taken up too much of the time, the four cases that I have on what to do if you maintain control of a university. Father Curran at Catholic University of America wrote contrary to Catholic doctrine. He was warned from the first day he arrived to let up, and he continued. They went for 18 years. They said that, and the Vatican finally got fed up with him and withdrew his canonical mission. He had this kind of a title. Told the university to get rid of him, and the university said it would be inconsistent with the university's special relationship with the Holy See, incompatible with the university's freely chosen Catholic character, and contrary to the obligations imposed on the university as a matter of canon law to ignore the Vatican declaration to get rid of him. So they fired him. He went to court, and he sued, and he said, "You don't have academic freedom at this university, and therefore you can't call it a university." The judge said, here was Father Curran's lawyer in court, "If you are a university, you have to have academic freedom and institutional autonomy. If you don't, you may be something else. You may be a seminary, you may be a catechetical institute, but you are not a university." Judge Weisberg responded that it may not have academic freedom. He can speak about it, scream about it, yell about it, but he can also leave. And they upheld the Catholic University and fired him, let him go. And he went on to be controversial elsewhere. Socrates was another problem. He was accused of corrupting the youth of Athens and impiety. He taught the youth to question authority, and in the end he went to trial, and he could have escaped. He could have done a number of things, but he didn't. And in the end, he drank hemlock. And so BYU professors, if you want to hold on right to the end, hemlock. Now, Galileo, he taught that the earth rotates around the sun, and everybody knew at the time that everything rotates around the earth. And they got him. And they brought him in, and in Bronowski's The Ascent of Man, they showed Galileo that if you don't recant, here's what's going to happen to you. And they showed him the instruments of torture. And then he gives us a little brief. And this is Sam and others of you in the audience at BYU, Bonner. Maybe we could get a tailor here and fit them for a rack. "I was brought to the rack, then mounted on top of it. My legs were drawn through two sides of a three-planked rack, a cord tied around my ankles, As the levers bent forward, the main force of my knees against the two planks burst asunder the sinews of my hams, and the lids of my knees were crushed. My eyes began to startle, my mouth to foam and froth, and my teeth to clatter like the doubling of a drummer's sticks. My lips were shivering, my groin was vehement, and my blood sprang from my arms, broken sinews, hands, and knees. Being loosed from these pinnacles of pain, I was handfast set to the floor with the incessant imploration, "Confess, confess." I like that. I think that when you think about the 1992s of spying, I think it's the equivalent of the rack 300, 400 years ago. Now, Galileo recanted, and he went on and he said, "I'm sorry that I did it wrong," and then he recanted. Now, let me just go quickly to another case of Salman Rushdie. "In the name of God Almighty, there is only one God to whom we should all return." This is the Ayatollah Khomeini after the Satanic Verses was published. "I would like to inform all the intrepid Muslims of the world that the author of the book entitled Satanic Verses, which has been compiled, printed, and published in opposition to Islam, the Prophet, and the Quran, as well as those publishers who were aware of its contents, have been sentenced to death." I like that too. There is no mamby-pamby stuff here. He says, "I call on all zealous Muslims to execute them quickly. No beating around the bush, no secret agendas, no spies. Just execute them wherever they find them so that no one will dare to insult the Islamic sanction. Whoever is killed in this path will be regarded as a martyr." Now, why can't the church issue a statement like that? Salman Rushdie. He caught on. He said, "Gosh, I'm sorry I did it. As author of Satanic Verses, I recognize the Muslims in many parts of the world are genuinely distressed by the publication of my novel. I profoundly regret the distress that publication has occasioned in the sincere followers of Islam. Living as we do in a world of many faces, this experience has served to remind us that we must all be conscious of the sensitivities of others." Iran responds after he says, "I'm sorry. Even if Salman Rushdie repents and becomes the most pious man in time, it is incumbent on every Muslim to employ everything he has got, his life and his wealth, to send him to hell." Now, these guys mean business. I like that, and I think the church ought to mean business, too. It's a mature church. It has means, and I think that if we really want to curtail BYU professors, let's do it right.
Given Omar's call for swift execution of dissenting voices, I'm delighted that I have very little time here. I'm also delighted because there may not be time for questions. My wife warned me when I left today to avoid questions. She knows that that's when I'm at my most vulnerable because I tend to speak quickly when asked a question. I will speak quickly and try to get us out of here close to on time. Omar's, I should say that as a member of the BYU faculty, I'm in a little different position. Or Brigham Young Seminary or Catechetical Institute or whatever we're going to rename it. I'm in a little different position than Omar, and I approached the Sunstone Symposium. Maybe I should also mention that I've known Omar for some 10 years when I was a senior at Brigham Young University. I had one of the loneliest jobs on campus. That is, I was the president of the BYU chapter of the College Democrats, and Omar was our advisor, and so he and I would sit in his office, and those were the meetings. it was interesting. I approached this with somewhat mixed feelings, as I told friends, some at BYU, some not at BYU, of my participation this year in Sunstone. I told them I was participating because the question of academic freedom is one of vital importance to me. But on the other hand, there is a perception that there is a sort of siege mentality at BYU, and in some quarters that's probably an accurate perception. Some friends warned me against coming at all, especially on this panel. Why don't you talk about something kind and gentle like Great Basin Kingdom That's because, you know, my father pulled rank and got that session. People pointed out to me that among the arguments against me coming were that my job is too important to jeopardize it, or that my membership in the church is too important to jeopardize it, or a neighbor yesterday who saw my badge as I was leaving the house to come up here simply said, I thought Sunstone was anti-church. And then her advice was, be careful, which I guess was well-meaning advice. And one of my colleagues, whose opinion I sought out and whose opinion I respect a great deal, who's not only very intelligent but also very savvy, which to me, given the current climate, means a lot more than being intelligent, said when asked for an opinion, given the current atmosphere, I would advise against it. So there is a sense, I think, that BYU faculty members who are willing to not wait for the next shoe to drop and to say something now are in a bit of a difficult position. And after all that, and with all of the with the official acknowledgement yesterday of the existence of the Committee on Strengthening Members and its function, the story's in this morning's Salt Lake Tribune if you haven't seen it. After all of that, I'm delighted to see that there's a money-making seminar next door. I may need the information. To put a couple of things in perspective, and then I'll conclude with comments specifically on Omar's paper and a couple of questions, I think that many seem to feel that this academic freedom document, which has been sent out to all the faculty of BYU in draft form, and comments have been elicited and have been coming in, and there are other drafts to be produced, that it was issued somehow in response to the LDS First Presidency statement last August about symposia. That actually is not the case. The process was well underway before August of last year. The committee, I believe, wasn't actually formed until February of this year, but the actual gestation period on the document that was sent to faculty on the 30th of April of this year was about a year long. It had been in the works for some time before last August. Omar, in his paper, I think, highlights one of the fundamental issues and tensions. When he asks, is it possible for BYU to manage the tension of being a church-sponsored university and meet the conflicting demands of its sponsor and the faculty? And that's the nub of the question, or at least one of the questions, the conflicting demands of its sponsor and the faculty. There is tension inherent, I think, between, on the one hand, and there's no sense denying it, on the one hand, a religious institution that's trying to promote not only faith in the abstract, but a particular kind of faith, and a classical university. And I think Omar made the case for this very strongly, that religion needn't be excluded from the notion of a full-flown, liberally educating classical university. It's the idea of a narrowly defined and orthodox faith that is to be promoted as the primary mission of the university that runs it headlong into the idea of a classical university. The reason that this becomes a conflict between the university's sponsor and many of the university's faculty is because by training, many of the faculty, most of the faculty, are coming out of places where there simply is no conflict. They strive to be classical universities and nothing else, and disavow any religious mission. And I think that, well, if nothing else, also as Omar suggested, faculty coming to BYU at the very least should have their eyes open about the tension that they're going to run into, and nobody should try to delude themselves. There's many at BYU, I will confess, are waiting right now to see what's going to happen next, waiting on the one hand for the promised implementation document that is supposed to spell out how the procedures in the academic freedom document are going to be implemented and the procedures for dealing with faculty who may run afoul of that document. But I think more than the implementation document, because any document is open to interpretations, including the academic freedom document, including, I'm certain, the implementation document. After all, it's still people, including the board of trustees that may not share some of the assumptions of the faculty. It's still up to people to make the final decision. So I think, unfortunately, what many people at BYU are waiting for, though many are not, Unfortunately, what many are waiting for are cases, somebody to be put on the rack. Nobody wants to be that person. I've talked to a lot of my colleagues, though, at least one of them acknowledges to me that he doesn't suspect he'll get tenure. But I think, unfortunately, there's this sort of morbid waiting going on to see who's going to be the first one, because you don't really know what the limits are. Despite what the document says, and I was going to read a portion of it, but there's not time. Despite what the document says, and you're probably all familiar with the three famous areas that are specified in the last part of the document, despite all of that, the only thing that will really clearly define the bounds over which one cannot step is going to be a case, somebody put on the rack, or somebody forced to recant. Now, there have been cases, as you're aware, in the past. I was going to, again, don't see me after if you want. I was going to read some of the documentation, including a couple of personal items from David Wright, who was fired a few years ago. Interestingly, in a letter to me, he said that he's not sure whether or not he would have been protected under the current document. He's not certain that he would have been fired because the document requires public pronouncements that run afoul of church doctrine, and he was fired for privately held beliefs. But I don't have time to read. Let me get to my own conclusion to this, and there might be a second or two for... There won't be a second or two for... Well, I'm safe. My wife will appreciate that. The problem that's at the core of much of the debate, I think, and I would agree with Omar that while there may be a hint of cynicism in parts of the document, it's a cynicism inherent in this conflict. I don't think... I know some of the people who have worked on this, and they're not cynical in their own approach. I don't know all of them, but this was produced by people who were wrestling with a very, very difficult problem. But it appears to me, and this is the problem as I see it that's at the core of much of the debate, it appears that the church, or BYU, is trying to redefine the classical idea of the university in order to fit a more narrowly defined religious mission, rather than seriously accepting the idea of a university and considering whether or not that fits the mission of the church. If it does, then there doesn't need to be so much hand-wringing about academic freedom, I think. And if it doesn't, then, as Omar said, the pretense should end. That doesn't necessarily mean that the church must divest itself of BYU, though that's one possible solution, and a solution fraught with difficulties that I didn't get to mention. But it should at least acknowledge that there is something, and I do believe this, there is something fundamentally at odds between religious indoctrination and the idea of the classical university. Unfortunately, that's all I have time for. My thanks to Omar for highlighting this issue and to you for your attention.
Thank you, Omar, and thank you, Michael. I'm sorry we don't have time for questions. If you have some, maybe you can catch them on your way out.